The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Okay, as we start, you know the old saw that whenever the preacher takes off his watch, puts it on the pulpit, you know what that means? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Okay, sorry. All right. Well, good afternoon. Welcome. My name is Jeff Trimbath, and I am here with my wife, Jill, and we are just so thrilled and delighted to be able to talk with you a little bit about admissions and development in the classical Christian school context. Just to begin, let's say you begin your school year in August of this year, and you're sort of doing some calculating, and turns out you've got more school year left than you do money in the bank. Gosh, what do we do? I know none of you have ever been in that situation. This is purely theoretical, purely hypothetical. Many of you might think, well, gosh, we've got to cut expenses. We've got to cut programs, cut plays, whatever. That's true. You might have to do some of that. But you also have two other options. You can figure out how to raise more money, and you can figure out how to get more people, more kids into your school. And so that's what this workshop is seeking to do, is to share with you 20 ideas, no or low-cost ideas, to get more students and more dollars into your school. The premise of the workshop, before we start, just want to give you the opportunity to continue our conversation. We have been given a mercilessly little amount of time for this workshop today, so we're hoping to continue the conversation with you. If you'd like to do so, I've put my cell phone number and my wife's cell phone number on the screen. You can feel free to text myself or my wife if you want to have a specific conversation about any subject that you would like to have related to development or admissions. And we will work as hard as we can to schedule a time for you to come and have a conversation with us. We'd love to do that as we're available. So I'll put this up at the end as well. The premise of the workshop is that you can increase the amount of money and the number of new students that come into your school by doing a few things differently. And so the goal of our time this afternoon is that you would come away with one or two maybe actionable ideas that you can put into practice right away to increase the amount of money or the number of kids who come into your school. Okay? Any questions on the premise or the goal of our workshop today that I can answer? Okay, good. Let's begin with development, and about halfway through, I'll bring my wife up to talk about admissions. Okay, development idea number one, change your mind. Change your mind. As I've worked with organizations around the country and with other fundraisers, I find that there's a fair amount of changing our mind that we need to do with regard to fundraising and money. We come to this subject with a bunch of presuppositions, many of them based in bad experiences that we've had in the past, or maybe a misunderstanding of Puritanism or whatever. I know where I come from in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, there are a lot of really unhealthy religiously based ideas that people have with regard to money. And so we have to shed some of those ideas. I've been struck reading through the Old and New Testaments again this year, how often the biblical writers refer to some aspect of raising money or asking the people of God to bring their gifts. Read through the Torah again and read especially how Moses inspired people to bring all kinds of things to build the temple, or to build the tabernacle. Read the classic passage in Paul, 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, where he praises the giving of the Macedonian Christians as they gave to the relief of the saints in Jerusalem. He's doing donor recognition right there in the pages of the New Testament. So fundraising is not a bad thing. We need to change our mind about fundraising. Change our mind also about our work, the regular work that we do as classical Christian educators. You know, every part, just about every part of the work that you do in a classical Christian school can be funded by charitable dollars. My favorite teacher in our little school in Loyola, Pennsylvania, is Deb Chapin. Some of you are going to have a chance to meet her tomorrow. She's our second grade teacher. I love Deb Chapin. Let's say there's someone else in your community, in our community, who comes in and just falls in love with the way that Deb deals with our second grade students and so on and says, you know what, I want to give a gift to fund the entire operations of Veritas Academy's second grade class that year. Guess what? That donor can do that. That donor can do that. So if he does that, are we going to then all of a sudden not charge the parents who send their kids that second grade tuition? No. No, we charge them tuition as well, and the generosity of that donor then makes way for the school to decide to do other things with that tuition money. So think about all the things you do that all of those things can be funded through charitable dollars, not necessarily through tuition dollars. And then finally, change your mind about who is responsible. Who is responsible for fundraising at your school? Oftentimes I'll interact with organizations and they'll say, you know, our fundraising is a little off this year because we're trying to hire a new development director or some other thing. And I stopped them right there. I said, no. Fundraising, my view, fundraising is the responsibility of every single employee, every single board member, every single parent. All of us have the responsibility to make sure the work that God has called us to do is adequately resourced. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to be out asking for money, everybody's going to be out writing a fundraising letter or that kind of thing, but we are all responsible for it. We all need to feel ownership to take part in the raising of funds for our organizations. So change your mind regarding the task of fundraising. Secondly, measure. Do you measure fundraising and fundraising activity in your schools? It's amazing to me, the number of organizations that I do work with and for, I ask the question, how much did you raise last year? And a lot of them simply don't know. I had a conversation with a board chair a couple of months ago, and we were talking about hiring a development director and so on. I said, well, how much did you do last year? He had no idea. He had no idea. Because the school didn't measure what they do. So measure, and let me just propose three very basic, kind of rudimentary metrics that you can think about using as you think about measuring fundraising. First, and in my view most important, is the total number of donors who are currently giving to your school. So take your activity last year, last calendar year, or last fiscal year, and try to figure out from your database how many total people gave to the school. Is that 10? Is it 100? Is it 1,000? What is that number? And figure out what you want that number to grow to in subsequent years, X plus N. And then figure out how you're going to get there, right? We talk about how to acquire new donors. So the number of new donors. Secondly, another suggested metric you may want to use is number of 1,000 and above donors. Now, you pick the number. For all of your institutions, a major gift is a different amount of money depending on your size, your sophistication, how long you've been around, so on and so forth. This $1,000 and above is just sort of my own guess at what a major gift might be for your school. But pick the number and track how many people gave at that level last year. And then do the same thing. Figure out how much do we want to grow that number by. And you can do this for all different parts, you know, 100 to 500, so on and so forth. But pick some level of a major gift and measure that. And then finally, the total dollars raised. That's the bottom line, right? How much are we actually bringing in? Track that. Okay, so measure. Number two. Number three, of all of the pieces of advice I'm going to share with you today, I think this one is the biggest bang for your buck. Thank your donors well. Jason Lewis said earlier today, any donors that you'll have for a capital campaign, or most of them, will come from your existing pool of donors. One of the ways that we can keep our donors, keep them giving to us, is to thank them well. I am shocked at the number of organizations that I interact with, that I both give to and that I help, that don't even think about this. So have you thought about how you thank donors? Is there someone on your team whose job it is to send out the letters? And organizations that I work for who've never thought about this or don't have a system in place, I usually say, look, let's take Tuesday mornings and Friday mornings. Those are thank you letter mornings. And a good thank you letter is three things. It's prompt, number one. Got to get out quickly. It's personal. It's dear Bob and Sally. It's not dear friend. So it's a merged letter. And third, it's powerful. It's linked in some meaningful way in the text to the mission of your school, and you are showing the impact of that person's gift. Little story here, Jill and I gave the largest gift we've ever given to a nonprofit last year. For us, it was the largest gift, several thousand dollars. Now, I know for many of you in this room, that may not be a lot of money. For us, it's a lot of money, okay? We gave the largest gift we ever gave last year to a nonprofit. A week went by, no thank you. 2 weeks went by, no thank you letter. 3 weeks went by, no thank you letter. I finally had to call the development office of the organization and say, you know what, we gave this gift 3 weeks ago. Could we get like an IRS tax letter to acknowledge our gift? How do you think we felt as a couple who had made the largest gift we had ever given to a nonprofit? How do you think we felt with regard to that nonprofit? Do you think we're more likely or less likely to support that nonprofit given the fact that they just didn't thank us? So thank your donors well. Idea number four, become a storyteller. We are all of us, are in the business of changing lives or saving lives. That's what we're doing through classical Christian education. Do you ever think about your task in those terms? How do we do that? How do we do that? Some of you may have studied stories and what makes the elements of good stories. Donald Miller has a wonderful podcast. You can just type in Donald Miller storytelling. He has this wonderful sort of metric or a sort of schema about good storytelling. And he talks about the Star Wars story and how that's a wonderful example of good storytelling. And we know there are two elements to a great story. The first is conflict, some sort of conflict. A certain person wants to get to a certain place, but there is resistance or some issue that comes up. And then secondly, there's a hero, someone who comes in and who saves the day. With regard to development, both writing and speaking, who is the hero with regard to classical Christian education? Is it the trivium? Is it Latin language? Is it the Western canon? All those things, as great as we love all those things. No, it's not any of those things. It's the donor. It's the donor who's the hero, because they're the ones who make our work possible. They're the ones, because of their gifts and generosity, they're the ones who make the education that little Sally, who would never have access to this great education, she has access to this because of the sacrificial giving of our donors. So become a storyteller. And also, part of this is telling stories about our donors. You tell stories about the incredible work that our donors do to inspire others to give as well. So become a storyteller. Number five, ask. It's funny, as I travel the country, you know, we've all had this experience being on a plane or an airport or something, and you strike up a conversation with someone, and they always ask, what do you do for a living? And I tell them, I do fundraising. And inevitably, the response is, I could never do that. I could never do that. And I've now come up with sort of a pat answer after doing this for 10 and a half years. I say, well, you know, I've noticed a really interesting correlation between asking and receiving. It's really interesting. And somebody really famous once noticed that same correlation with regard to spiritual things, right? There is this correlation between asking and receiving. We have to ask. We've got to be out there asking. Who asks for money for your school? Who are the people on your team that does that? How do they do that? Do they do it in writing? Is there a systematic way that they do that? Do they do that through personal appointments? Do they do it through email, over the phone? All these kinds of things. What steps are you taking right now to get over any apprehension that you might have regarding the task of asking? We have to be asking for the gifts if we want to receive them. Number six. Matches motivate and deadlines urge. Okay, so matches, these are two tactics that you can think about employing as you communicate with folks to raise money. I think matches are wonderful. In the earlier session that Jason led, we had one of your colleagues talked about a wonderful match opportunity that one of his donors gave. He said, I'll give you $500,000 if you can promise that you're going to raise $500,000 to match it, right? So with matches, there are two kinds of people. There are people who like to throw down the match, like this particular donor said, sort of the alpha male type. I'm here, you know, I want people to respond to me, right? I'm the leader of this. There are others who like to respond to matches, more the frugal type, right? I know that if I give you this $1,000 or $10,000, it's going to be automatically double because of this match that's in place. So utilize matches. Seek out people who are currently giving to you who you think will be motivated either way, on either side of that transaction. And then Secondly, make strategic use of deadlines. We all, or most schools that I've dealt with, have a fiscal year, and we all have a calendar year, right? So the fiscal year typically is 6:30, and the calendar year is 12:31. I hope you are utilizing those two very important deadlines to communicate with your donors to give now. Help us finish strong now. At the Heritage Foundation, which is where I work, 50% of all of our major gift income comes in the last 8 weeks of the year. So you better believe we are making as great a use of that 12:31 deadline as we possibly can. And I encourage you to do that as well. So plan out the last quarter of the year. What's my communication strategy like? How am I going to do that? What are the emails I'm sending out? What are the letters I'm sending out? How are we going to do telephone follow-up? What's my plan for the fact that my school is closed for the last week of the year between Christmas and New Year's, and I might get a call on December 30th from someone who wants to make a last-minute appreciated asset stock transfer? What am I going to do, right? Think about those things. And also utilize those deadlines to encourage people to give. And the calendar is full of other deadlines, not just fiscal year, not just year-end, but tax time, beginning of school year, the end of school year, harvest, Easter could be a great motivator. I don't know. I mean, there's a ton of deadlines you can use in your communication to inspire donors to give. So use deadlines and matches. Number 7, rethink events with donors in mind. I attended a wonderful workshop this morning. It's awesome. These workshops have been great. With a headmaster who had his whole year planned out. And several of those little line items on that calendar were events. Your schools and our school, where we send our kid, have these wonderful events that take a lot of energy and a lot of time. So have you thought about rethinking some of those events that you're already doing with donors in mind? 2 ideas in this little heading here. Number 1, have you thought about offering to donors the ability to take some role, some part, in those events, like a prayer? Some of you may say the Pledge of Allegiance before some of your events. Offer that to a donor. By doing that, you're asking a donor not only to just give you their money, but to give you something for many donors is far more important than that, and that is the gift of public affiliation. Will you please take part in this program, allow us to introduce you, and lead us in this prayer, or lead us in the pledge, or introduce our speaker, whatever, and thereby give us that wonderful gift of affiliation. So rethink them by giving them a role in the program. Also, you might want to have a little reception beforehand, or sort of an exclusive reception for those $1,000 and above or $500 and above donors. Special access kind of thing. Okay? Rethink events with donors in mind. Number 8, start a giving society. How many of you get fundraising solicitations from your alma maters, from your colleges and universities, right? We all do. Did you ever notice they have all these societies? You know, give X amount and you're a part of this society or this giving club or whatever. Why do they do that? Why do they all have these things at various levels? I'll give you the answer. They do that because it works. It works at inspiring people to move up the ladder, to give more and more. And so I encourage you to do that same thing with your schools. Start a giving society at a certain level of giving and offer benefits with that. They don't have to be huge benefits. Maybe a quarterly letter or a monthly letter that you send just to that group of people. Maybe a conference call that you get them on. Maybe it's invitations to special events or special sort of access, that kind of thing. You can put together a nice package of benefits to offer as part of that society to encourage people to do that. It is a means of getting people to move up. You can also do it for legacy givers. We've had a wonderful panel discussion on transition. Whenever you have leadership transition organization, that is a wonderful time to talk about legacy giving. And Legacy Society could be part of that. Number 9, I'm saving one of the most painful topics for at the end of my talk here. Enlist your board. I think, at least the organizations I've dealt with, I think we're facing a scandal. I think many of our boards don't think that they have responsibility to fund the organizations that they help to lead. They may exercise leadership in other ways, but in terms of philanthropic leadership, in terms of living up the definition of this word trustee, which includes the word fiduciary, not happening. So I would encourage you all to think about minimum standards of giving for your board members. Whatever that is, you decide, okay? But they have to have skin in the game. It is not an obligation. It's just not an obligation at all. It's a privilege for them to be able to serve, and they can lead. I think, and this is what I tell organizations, that board members who serve in our organization ought to be the number two or number three charity that they support personally. I understand we are all believers. I come from the evangelical Protestant tradition where tithing is really important. So your church will be your number one. I get that. But if you're serving on our board, it's number two, or maybe it's number three. But we ought to be the top of your list in terms of your own personal or business support. What do we want board members to do? We want them to give as much as they possibly can give because they are so compelled by our mission and our vision. We also want them to ask for as much money as they possibly can ask for. And then also, on top of that, we want them to introduce us to people of influence and affluence in our community who we can ask for funds for our organization. We want them to be ambassadors, to host fundraisers for us at their club or at their home. We want them to bring people to campus, at our school campus or a sports campus, so on and so forth, so that we're always exposing the great work that we're doing to more and more people. Maybe you want to think about starting a development committee of the board whose task it is to look over this important function for the school that oversees the activity in this area, oversees the measuring of results, and oversees all of this kind of stuff. So enlist the help of your board. And then finally, give philanthropic awards. One of the rules of fundraising that I've discovered in my decade plus of doing this work is how you treat your existing donors tells your future donors how you will treat them. How you treat your existing donors tells future donors how you will treat them. And so one of the ways you can really honor your existing donors is by giving an award. And I'm not talking about some trinket that you've got to order off of some website that's going to cost you $50 or $100. Look, people who are giving you $10,000 a year don't need more stuff. They just can buy it if they want it, right? But what about a board resolution? A resolution that says, whereas Sally Jo has been involved in our school for 10 years. She has given faithfully over those 10 years. She's served, selflessly. And so therefore, we as a board of governors are honoring her for all of the contributions she has made. Put it on nice letterhead, frame it, give it to her at a board meeting, take some pictures, put it in your email newsletter, boom. Wow, powerful. Tells others how you'll treat them when they step up to invest. So those are 10 quick and dirty ideas that I think if you put some of those into practice, you will materially benefit the schools that you're giving your lives to. We'll have some time for questions at the end, but now it's my privilege to introduce my wife, Jill Trimbeth, who's going to share some ideas with regard to admissions.
Good afternoon. It is my privilege to be here with you today, and I have served as the Director of Admissions at Veritas Academy in Lancaster, Pennsylvania for the past 5 years. And I really do love having the opportunity to talk with families as they make the critical decision as to where to educate their children and how to educate their children. And I know when Jeff and I were approaching the school age for our oldest child, it was really something we wrestled with. And so I hope you all appreciate as you work in admissions capacity an opportunity it is to come alongside these parents as they try to be faithful and make good decisions for their children's future. I just wanted to say Ty and Pam this morning spoke about very good principles related to growing your school's enrollment. I hope to just go over some very practical tips, some things that we have used, some tactics that we have tried to increase enrollment at our school, and I hope that these will be practical tips for you. Obviously, before we bring more students into our school, we need to make sure that our school is visible to the community. And this is sometimes a challenge. I would encourage you to not waste money on expensive billboards and radio and newspaper ads that are very broad and that are not really focused on your target audience. We've had some very helpful interactions with Scola Inbound Marketing, and they have really given us some great suggestions about how to target our online marketing to reach the people who are searching for schools in your community. Also, don't forget that your current parents are your greatest asset. And whenever I have the chance to speak in front of our current parents, I always remind them of this, always remind them that they should be talking with their friends and family and inviting them to events, and remind them of the important role they play. Whenever you have prospective parents come in, make sure you ask them how they heard about your school. And I will tell you that most of the time, they've heard about it from one of your current parents. So just make sure you always keep that at the forefront. Idea number two, serve preschool families in your area. Several years ago, there was a preschool in our area that started an event called a preschool parent date night. And they invited Christian K through 12 schools to send their high school students there for the evening to serve as the babysitters while the parents of the preschoolers went out for the night and enjoyed free childcare. Our school faithfully sent high school students each year, and in exchange, I got to stand in the lobby and talk with all the preschool parents as they came in and dropped off their children. And I know that there are several families at our school who came as a result of meeting us at that preschool date night. So it's something very simple that you can do, and I was amazed that very few schools took advantage of this opportunity. Well, we now have our own preschool at Veritas, and we have started doing the same thing for our own preschool community. So we do a date night, our high school students come over and serve, and I get the chance to talk with our preschool parents, because many of those parents are not necessarily thinking about sending their kids to our K through 12 school, they're just thinking about preschool right now, so it's great to be in front of them. Idea number three, create a word-of-mouth team. This is something that we have just started doing in the last couple of years in a more formal way. We've always done it in an informal way. But choose some of your very young and enthusiastic parents, especially new parents, and invite them to be part of a word-of-mouth team. This team does not need to involve a great time commitment for the parents, but it is something where you can just meet with them a couple of times a year and communicate with them by email and phone and share good news with them. So if you have a sudden spike in enrollment, make sure you share that with your current parents and that they spread the word. If you have a student who has a great accomplishment or a teacher who is awarded a special award, make sure you get that out to your word of mouth team so that they can share it with others. They can also help in very practical ways, hanging posters for different events, writing online reviews. This is something they can do from the comfort of their own living room. They can just sit down and write some reviews, and others will see those when they search for your school online. And, of course, connecting the word-of-mouth team with your prospective parents is always a great idea. So if I have a prospective parent who has particular questions about what it's like to be involved with sports at our school, I make sure I call one of the word-of-mouth team members who has a child in athletics and get them connected. Idea number four, use your Facebook page effectively. Most of you probably have a Facebook page for your school, and one thing that I have noticed since we started ours is that parents love high-quality photos on the Facebook page, right? We all love to see great photos of our own children. And so make sure you have a good photographer taking pictures. You're posting them regularly on your Facebook page, and parents will share them, and that will spread the word about your school, just that simple act. Interestingly, parents don't always know how to share a post or a photo, so remind them that it's not just a matter of liking something on Facebook, but they really need to share it so that it's dispersed to all of their friends. And we certainly use our Facebook page to post school tour invites. We have a blog, and we put links to our blog on there so that if there's great content, our current parents will see that great content, will share it on their page, and then many others will see it as well. Admissions idea number five is to plan a quality community event. For the last couple of years, we've been planning an admissions lecture, and we have this during the height of admissions season in January, February, March, and choose a great topic and a very convenient venue. So I'm not talking about having this event at your school, but maybe at a public library or at a community center, somewhere very neutral, and pick a topic that the community will be excited about. We, for the last 2 years, have done the topics of the Common Core and manners, and have had sold out crowds both times. And we have, of course, invited our current parents, but we've really encouraged them to invite people outside of the Veritas community to come to the event. And we've even provided some incentives. So if they get someone to come to the event who's outside of the community, they get a free copy of the book that's written by the author who's presenting at the event. Also take advantage of all the events that you already have going on at your school. So I'm sure you have lots of great concerts and school plays. Make sure that you, if you're working in admissions, invite prospective parents to those events. It's okay to invite them even though they're not part of the community yet. Even things like senior thesis or graduation, this gives them the big picture. They get to see a glimpse of where the students are headed. Idea number six is to plan a great school tour. I'm sure you all do school tours, but you want to make that school tour a memorable experience for the families who are walking in the door. We plan group school tours. We typically have two a month during the second half of the school year, but I do try to be as flexible as possible with families who can't come to those group tours. I know it can be a pain in the neck to do lots and lots of individual school tours, but I think it really pays off. Meet them where they are. So if they can't come to your typical school tour, but they can come at the end of the school day on a Friday, even though it's not the best time to do it, go ahead and do a school tour at that time. Make sure when they do come in that the prospective parents are seeing the big picture. So if it's a student, if it's a family who's coming in and they have an oldest child coming into kindergarten, don't just take them to kindergarten. Take them to kindergarten, take them to another grammar school class, make sure you hit a high school class. And I almost always try to include a high school student in the tour as well. Involving dynamic students in the tour is a great way for prospective parents to see what you're all about. And of course, choosing dynamic teachers. You're going to want to go into a number of different classrooms, but I think it's also great to pull a teacher out of the classroom and allow them to talk one-on-one with the prospective parents. And make sure you thank your teachers. I know is disruptive, and I try as much as possible to thank them for being flexible and to let them know that they're really playing an important role in growing the enrollment of the school. Admissions idea number seven is to establish an ambassador program. We have an ambassador program, which is a program in which we invite high school juniors and seniors to apply to be ambassadors for our school, to represent our school, particularly in school tours, but perhaps when meeting with donors or other situations. I always like to remind students when I put out this plea for applications that this is a great resume builder. So if they become a Veritas ambassador, this is something they can put on their college applications or on job applications. Make sure once you, for our Veritas ambassadors, the way we handle the application process is they fill out a written application and then they do an interview with myself and another administrator so that we can really choose students who will represent the school well. However, once you choose those students, make sure that they are trained and they feel confident and prepared to go into situations where they're talking with prospective parents. I usually try to just do a little bit of role playing with them, throw out some questions that are typically asked by prospective parents so that they have a chance to think through how they would answer those questions. And let them know that it's okay to share negatives also. You know, we know that our schools are not perfect, and inevitably, prospective parents will ask, what do you not like about the school? Or what's the weakness of the school? And so make sure they're prepared to answer that question as well. Also, as you employ students in the school tours, make sure you choose the student carefully for each tour. So I usually look at who's coming into my school tour each week, and if I see that both families are coming from a public school background, then I look at my list of ambassadors and make sure I choose a student who came from the public school and transitioned into our school. Whenever possible, it's great. They can really answer a lot of questions and take care of addressing any fears that the family might have about that transition. Idea number eight really parallels some of the things that Jeff already talked about with donors. It is essential that you follow up promptly and write thank you notes. And I know it's time consuming sometimes seems tedious, but I think it's important to try to follow up within 24 hours after having someone come in and visit your school. And typically I try to do a handwritten thank you note. I think that stands out because in our culture, Not many people receive handwritten thank you notes anymore. However, if you can't do that, sending an email or following up with them by phone, just make sure that they know that you're still thinking about them after they walk out the door. Also, be specific in your note and make sure you answer any unresolved questions. If there were some questions that they had at the end of the tour and you didn't get to address fully, make sure you follow up with those. And this is a great time to involve current parents. So if you can tell that there are certain barriers or issues that the prospective parent is struggling with, think about your current parents and make sure that you offer to put them in touch with each other. Just a simple phone call or email to connect them will really go a long way. Also, for prospective students, typically older prospective students, I like to offer shadowing opportunities for the students to come in and stay with their peers for half a day or a full day. It helps to have the buy-in of the students. So if it's a student who's going into seventh grade, if the parents are really excited but the student's not, it's not going to go very well. So make sure that you offer that opportunity for the student to come in and shadow the class. Admissions idea number 9, connect new parents to the community. So the job of the admissions director is not over once they sign the enrollment form and start paying tuition. It's important to make sure that they're getting integrated and getting involved with the school community as quickly as possible. Having events in the summertime, I believe that always helps. So it can be something as simple as a play date at the park for new grammar school students, and invite all of your students, your current students and your new students, so that they can start to form relationships. Also, planning a parent orientation is a great way for the parents to start to feel connected to the school. It doesn't need to be anything elaborate, but it really should be a blessing to these new parents. So we've started doing an orientation where we provide dinner to the parents, and they come in and have dinner together, they enjoy fellowship, and then we just go through a lot of the nuts and bolts of what a typical day looks like, what you can expect on the first day of school, what the school calendar looks like, just refreshing their minds, and a lot of things that they probably heard when they came in for the parent interview several months before, but they really need a refresher at that time. Also, I definitely recommend assigning mentor parents and student buddies. So in the summertime, right at this time of year is when I start to look through my list of new parents and connect them with current parents. And I try to have this not be a huge burden for our current parents, but I ask them to do two things. Send one email and place one phone call to their assigned new parent. It's not a big deal. Some of them go above and beyond and invite the family over for dinner or get together for coffee. But it's really great, even for very nitty-gritty questions like school uniform questions. How do I know which uniform they wear which day and that kind of thing? It's very helpful. For our older students, our secondary students, I also assign a buddy for them for the first day of school, just so they know that when they arrive on the first day of school, someone will be looking for them and will be with them throughout the day. And finally, admissions idea number 10. After things settle down and the school year begins, make sure that you have all of your raw numbers and watch for trends. So by raw numbers, I'm talking about the number of people who contacted you each year, the number of people who came in for a visit, the number of those who actually applied, and then of those who applied, who actually enrolled. It's really important to keep track of that data so that you can see the trends over the years and make adjustments and figure out where you're losing people. At what point in the process did you lose someone and why? Also, find out why parents did not choose your school. I know this can be an uncomfortable conversation, but I think it's essential. I just had this conversation yesterday with someone who sent me a quick email and said we made our decision to go elsewhere. So I called them and just said, can you just tell me why, explain a little bit about why you chose the school you chose, and, is there anything that we could do better? It's really essential to improving your process. Also, as part of admissions, I conduct the exit interviews with families who leave the school. And there might be different people in your school doing this, but I think it works well to have someone do a formal exit interview when a family chooses to leave your school. So again, typically I would do this in the summertime, and I contact them by phone and ask if we can set up a formal time to do the exit interview and just go through a series of questions. This is essential feedback. You need to know why people are leaving, what they were unhappy about, and what they really loved about the school. And finally, conduct a new parent interview, a new parent survey. Your new families come into the school, they get rolling with the school year, and once you get into about October or November, it's a great time to send out a survey to the new parents and get their feedback on the admissions process and also the start of the school year, and make sure they're happy. And if there are any concerns, it's a great time to address them before things get too far along. So I think we have a couple of minutes left, and we would love to hear any questions you have, or ask also any practical suggestions, things that have worked well at your school. Yes. I would. Yes. If you send me an email, I'd be happy to send them to you. Yeah. Or you can text me, since you have that number here. That might be the easiest. If you text me your information, I'd be happy to send those to you. That's fine. Either one's fine. Yes. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Oh, great. Yeah, you know, it is a hurdle, but if you, and Jason, I don't know if he's still here or not, but if they've done extensive surveys on why people give, and universally the last reason is tax benefit. Universally the number one reason, agreement with the mission. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't think that the tax benefit would be, in fact, I do work with organizations that are C4s, which are lobbying nonprofits, and PACs, which are political nonprofits. Candidates, you know, people do fundraising for candidates all the time. Ain't no tax break with those donations. And there is a ton. Boy, this Georgia race, you guys see this? $50 million they raised in that race. Not a dollar of that was tax deductible. So, yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, well, I'll tell you what we do at our school. We have an enrollment. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, so her question was about enrollment fees. Do we have an enrollment fee? And if we have that fee, is it refundable, or do they lose it if they change their mind in the summertime? So at our school, we have a $250 enrollment fee that goes up to $350 after a certain date. It is generally not refundable unless they apply for financial aid and the financial aid award is not sufficient. In that case, we will refund the money. Typically, though, if they just change their mind and decide to go elsewhere, it would not be refundable. It's separate from tuition. No, we don't have anything like that. Yeah. Any
Who
other?
Else? Yeah.
Yep.
For Jill, what percentage of your school budget goes toward funding some of these events or spending money on marketing those kinds of things?
Well, Mr. Fisher's over there in the corner. I don't know. I don't know about the marketing. Our admissions budget's very small, I can tell you that. you know, the events that we do are very low cost. We do. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, so my budget's very small. Marketing budget would be different.
And the other thing, too, is for any of these events, you can raise the money. So for some of these community events, we've had donors pay for the entire amount.
Right.
Whole thing.
Have
so
the admissions lecture, for example.
Yeah.
He's looking into that. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. So the question that he just asked was for my school tours and open houses, am I partnering with our marketing folks? And yes. So I mentioned Scola Inbound Marketing. They've been very helpful in making sure that the word gets out primarily online about our events. So sending out targeted emails and Facebook ads, Facebook posts, that kind of thing. So they are partnering with us and getting the word out. In terms of... Well, we only do one open house each year. So I don't know. Everybody uses different terminology. Typically, almost all of the folks I meet with throughout the school year come in during the school day and do a tour during the school day, and I just call those school tours. Our open house, we just do one on a Saturday in the spring, and that's a time where we bring some students and teachers and administrators in, and we invite people to come into that event. For us, that's not been a huge event. School tours have actually been much more popular. Yeah? Are we on time?
Yeah. Me? Yeah. Well, gosh, the category of non-government grants is really wide, right? I mean, so there are all kinds of foundations. I sort of think of these. Okay, so let me. So, what are my thoughts of this? There are some private funders who have application processes that are worse than the government, and I know because I used to run. Government grant programs. There used to be this thing called abstinence education. Anybody ever hear of this? Used to be a government-funded function here in the United States, and then the Obama administration came in and changed it to a condom distribution program. Same thing, right? The money that I gave out was easier to get than some private funders that I've tried to get to. So much so that at Heritage, for example, there are some, and I'd be glad to tell you who they are, after the break. But you have to do a cost-benefit analysis of how much squeeze is this juice really worth, right? How much time are you going to devote to this really complicated process? The non-government grants that I like are controlled by small private family foundations because that's just another checkbook. That's another checkbook for a local business guy to write, and there's one decision maker. I want to get to that decision maker, build a relationship with him or her, and convince her to make a gift to us. Big subject, but yeah. Yep, turquoise. Is it one more? And we'll go all afternoon if you'd like, but I know.
I think we're out of time.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I feel like we get a couple of these questions each year, not a ton. Her question was about special ed students, and I think if I'm understanding you correctly, they're looking to leave the public school and just move into a small class environment and hoping that they'll be served better. I think usually it's just a matter of, I try to talk with them on the phone as much as possible and get a good understanding of what the needs are. And before they even come in for a visit, make sure we understand if we can serve the student. Because like you, we don't have a special ed teacher, we don't have a special ed program, we have learning support that's very minimal not for students with special learning disabilities. So I would say as much information as you can get ahead of time, that's great. I've sometimes asked them to fax records to me and then show it to our administrators and get a sense of whether or not it's someone we can serve. And I think parents appreciate that if we can't serve them, we're not going to waste their time and have them come in and visit if it's not the right place for them. I think we need to leave.
Okay, well, thank you very much again. If you want to... If you want to continue the conversation, please text us. We'd be delighted to get together with you, and thank you for all that you do.